We own this country.
We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we've got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Good evening. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio, and this is your Culture Vigilante Hour. We're here every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m., and we are here to help you take your country back. You need to take care of this yourself as a culture vigilante because no one else is going to do it for you. And obviously, they're not doing it for you because things aren't going particularly well in that area anyway. We are waking up from our tryptophan coma from Thanksgiving last Thursday evening, and with us tonight also coming out of his coma is Dave Court, Mr. Hour of Truth. How are you tonight, Dave?
I'm good. How are you, Lisa?
I'm good. How was your Thanksgiving?
Oh, it was great. It was great. Lots of food, lots of fun, lots of family. It's just my favorite holiday of the whole year.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm still trying to, we're still trying to dig out of the pumpkin pie over here. We've been eating leftovers for a solid week, and I haven't had to cook, which is pretty good.
Yeah, we didn't have any leftovers. A handful of turkey for the dog the next day, and that's all we had left over.
Well, I guess that's a pretty good deal. Excuse me. I've been just exhausted today. I did a really stupid thing last night. I must be the very last person on the planet who is finding out what this Angry Bird thing is. Do you know what Angry Birds are, Dave?
Yes, I do.
Oh, God. Okay. I have teenagers, and I don't know why I didn't know about Angry Birds. Okay, but they introduced me to Angry Birds. They downloaded this Angry Bird thing on my iPad, and, you know, I hate video games. I don't play video games. I don't get involved in them. And, you know, and I saw these little Angry Birds in places, and I thought it was about the Cardinals. You know, I thought this was like, because I'm in St. Louis, you know. I thought it was a Cardinal thing. So last night, before I go to bed, I couldn't get to sleep, so I grabbed my iPad, and my kids were teaching me how to play Angry Birds last night. And I thought, okay, so I'll go and I'll play Angry Birds for a few minutes. And I was playing Angry Birds until 1:30 in the morning. I could not get past the second level, couldn't kill the darn pigs. And I've got Angry Birds flying everywhere. And I'm like, what in the heck am I doing with these stupid Angry Birds? I'm totally disconnected from the culture.
Easy to see how kids can get consumed with that, isn't it?
Oh, my God. It's ridiculous. And, I mean, I'm doing Angry Birds until 1:30 in the morning. That app's coming off my iPad tomorrow. My son is in here laughing at me like crazy. I'm on the air, Derek. Yeah, well, there's your culture for your culture vigilante. Don't get involved in Angry Birds. It's just totally
stay away from the Angry Birds.
It keeps you up at night. Oh,
yeah.
Ridiculous.
I happen to agree with it.
Oh, my son, he will defend video games till the death.
Sure.
So, I have my lottery ticket. We're going to get through the show as quickly as we can tonight so that we can sit by the computer and wait for the lottery numbers to come in. Do you have your lottery ticket there?
I buy $10 every drawing. So
do you really?
Yeah.
Well, if I'm not here next week, you'll know what happened.
Oh, okay. There you go.
I'll have the lottery thing, and I'll be on a beach somewhere being drinks.
Half a billion raw numbers. You'd get about $120 million if you take the cash.
Well, is that it?
Yeah. Well, what do you mean, is that it? I've lived on less.
Yeah, and the Obama thing. So can you open up offshore accounts with $120 million?
Oh, yeah, you can open up several offshore accounts. What I would do, of course, is I would turn that the bulk of that into something a little bit more solid, you know, a gold, real estate, things that are going to hold value regardless of how many wheelbarrows full of dollars it takes to buy a loaf of bread.
Really? So, yeah, but the Obama thing, I'm worried about the taxes, you know. I'm thinking offshore accounts, we need to get that out of the country real quick, because the last I heard, and I haven't really done any research into it, but I've been reading things about your 401ks are the next to be targeted by the Obama administration.
Yeah, I am. I downloaded my 401k and tucked it away in something a little bit more substantial.
That's a little scary, because that was supposed to be the safest thing that you could have, was your 401k.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm thinking offshore accounts now, just like Mitt.
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem with offshore accounts is dollars are dollars. So when your million dollars becomes worth $150,000 because of inflation, it's not going to matter where your $1 million is. If it's in dollars.
But if you've been listening to the show every week, we're all going to be, our land is all going to be taken away from us too with Agenda 21. So that's not safe either. So if you invest in real estate, you're not going to be allowed to do that either, or the government will confiscate it.
You can buy real estate somewhere else though, and it will hold its value.
Yeah.
Buy real estate in the Bahamas or in Veracruz.
In another country.
Like that. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, on a beach, where they serve umbrella drinks.
Exactly. Exactly.
And sunscreen. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing. Umbrella drinks and sunscreen.
There you go.
And you'll never hear from me again. I bet there are a lot of establishment Republicans that are hoping that I win the lottery.
I'll bet there are, yeah.
She'll go away. She'll never talk again. She'll get off the radio. She'll shut up. She'll quit bashing us. That'd be great. Something else we kind of need to make folks aware of is that the UNCRPD is up for discussion. I got an HSLDA alert today, and it's been on the radar very heavily for the last couple of days. Mike Ferris sent out an alert, and he states, yesterday afternoon, the Senate took a preliminary vote on the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child of Persons with Disabilities. It's UNCRPD. The vote was on a motion to proceed, which means that the Senate gave permission to begin debate regarding this treaty. As often is the case, this was a preliminary vote, which tells us a great deal about the vote for final passage. It was a 61-36 vote to proceed on debate, and they are urging everyone to contact their representatives, and I will post something up on MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org to help you get an easier link to some phone numbers and email addresses so that you can burn up the phone lines tomorrow. We absolutely do not want this to go forward. It's a huge infringement on your rights. And in my opinion, I mean, I got an email from Roy today, and basically denouncing the UN treaty, but, you know, they seem to feel that it's their constitutional obligation to entertain these ideas, which is beyond me. I don't think it's their constitutional obligation to entertain these ideas. I don't think it's our constitutional obligation to be in the UN in the first place. And why we're even entertaining these, being in the UN is totally beyond me. Because everything that comes out of the UN completely disengages all of our rights, from the Constitution. So anyway, folks, look on MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org after the show, and I will get something up this evening. I will not be playing Angry Birds. I will be working on the computer to get you that information so that you can call your representatives in Washington, D.C., and tell them not only to do not support these treaties, get the hell out of the U.N. all the way around. We got a pretty good show lined up for you tonight. We got some interesting things on the hopper here for you. We'll have Darren Morley from Reboot Congress. He's got some information for us on some more email scandals from the EPA. Emails are just, you know, the popular thing. Everything's all about emails in Washington, D.C. Seems that Elisa Jackson of the EPA has been creating some funny email accounts and hiding some information. We'll have Darren give us a complete rundown in history on that. We'll have Liz Trent from Spirit of Resistance talk to us about what it means to have medical jihad. We have some issues with some possible, I don't want to say terrorist activity. You can't really, I guess, qualify it as terrorist activity, but medical jihad is a term that all of us need to be familiar with here in the United States. And later on, again, we will have Ray Cuneo with us. And speaking of terms, there are a lot of buzzwords that are floating around right under our noses that connect us to the UN and Agenda 21, and Ray Cuneo is going to help us become familiar with those terms so that we can spot those out a little bit more clearly and be aware of what red flags need to be raised when our legislators and our local representatives are trying to push through legislation. Right now, we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back with Darren.
I'm telling you why.
Here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, it's Christmas in July and August and September. Last year on Christmas Eve, MGC paid off the department store layaway accounts of two Missouri families who were not able to provide Christmas for their children. This year, we would like to at least double that number, and in an attempt to do that by the holiday season, we're asking you to consider donating a few dollars toward that effort. We know the holiday season is the most difficult time of year to ask for donations, so we're planning ahead and asking you to give whatever you can so that a few Missouri families will be able to celebrate at Christmas. Go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and look for the Secret Santa page. All the details are there for you to donate by PayPal, check, or money order. Conservatives have proven to be the most generous and most benevolent people in the United States. Please help us with this very small charitable project. We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio, and this is your Culture Vigilante Hour. And I actually have some good news for a change. Rather than just complaining all the time, I have something great to say. We've reached our goal. Missouri Grassroots Secret Santa program has actually reached our goal. Thanks to our good friend, I got an email from my good friend Marshall, and he has pledged to put us over the top. We weren't that far from it, and he's going to give me a check on Friday, and we're going to deposit that and give that to the folks at Missouri Grassroots Coalition so that we can go out on Christmas Eve and take care of business and help some Missouri families who've had a hard time at Christmas time. We really appreciate all the donations that folks have given us up to this point. We really think that this is a very good charitable project that we can do to help some people right here in Missouri and some kids right here in Missouri keep the magic of Christmas alive. And again, I want to thank Marshall for putting us over the top there. But that doesn't mean that you, if you have the desire to give, we will put every penny that comes to us for this project, we will put it towards the families. We will spend every dime on Christmas for those families this year. So if you still want to continue to serve or to donate to us, please send us. Go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and go to the Secret Santa page, and you can send us a check or money order or pay through PayPal, and we will double whatever we take in this year. We intend to double for next year. We're going to raise our goal to double that amount for next year and help twice as many families next year. So again, thank you to Marshall. Thank you to all the great donors that helped us out with this project this year, and we look forward to being able to spread a little Christmas cheer due to your generosity. And with us tonight, we have Darren Morley of Reboot Congress. And Darren he's here in St. Louis. He's a member of the St. Louis Tea Party. He's been on with us before. He's probably one of the best investigative bloggers I've ever read. Darren comes up with some incredible information. I don't know where he finds it, but he does. He finds some great stuff. He was on with us a few weeks ago, and he had uncovered some incredible information about Claire McCaskill and her husband and how they are becoming rich. We'll just move on from that. Well, they're becoming very rich off the taxpayers' money and the benefit of Claire's position in the Senate. And Darren has some more information about some interesting email accounts and some possible cover-ups in the EPA. Thanks for being with us tonight, Darren.
Thank you, Lisa. Thanks for the opportunity to visit again with you.
If you haven't read Darren, he's at rebootcongress.net, and he's written several articles in the last couple of weeks on Lisa Jackson of the EPA. And Darren, I'm just going to go ahead and let you give us a full background on all of this. Why don't you start from the very beginning and just kind of give us a history?
Okay, so I first came across the work of Christopher Horner, who is the author of The Liberal War on Transparency. He's also works at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI. And CEI and Horner have filed multiple FOIA requests to get information out of the EPA and other government agencies, but we're going to focus today on the Environmental Protection Agency. They've filed multiple requests through the Freedom of Information Act, and they're concerned that the EPA has dragged their feet, and two, that they've tried to evade providing all of the information that they're required by law to provide. Now, one thing I should mention before I proceed is how FOIA works. So in a FOIA request, when you request emails from somebody in the federal government through a FOIA request, the person whose emails you're requesting is the person who provides that information. So when Christopher Horner requested emails from Lisa Jackson at the EPA, it's Lisa Jackson at the EPA who provides those emails. She reviews them and then provides them to a sort of jurisdictional or judicial body within the agency, I think, that reviews the content for any information that may need to be rescinded or whatever based on other considerations, you know, to comply with the federal FOIA Act. And so the concern that Horner has about getting information is kind of driven by the fact that we have come to find out that there's at least one what I'll call sock puppet email account that Lisa Jackson is using, and that account is under the name Richard Windsor. The EPA actually provides an interface on their website. If you go to epa.gov, you have to actually click on a few things, but you'll get to a page that allows you to look up any employee at the EPA. So if you type in, say, Lisa Jackson, you'll pull up the information on Lisa Jackson. You get her email address, her phone number. I'm sure the phone number is answered by a secretary or something, but her email address is there. And I think that because of the amount of email that she gets at that email address, she generally doesn't use it for business work. Now, I can understand that. But I don't think that creating an alias, which is what she's done, under the name of Richard Windsor, is really the way to go. Now, I could understand having a different account, but when you have an account that's under an assumed name, that obfuscates the identity of the person with that account. And that's really, I think, where the problem comes in.
So who is Richard Windsor?
Well, that's an interesting question. We don't know definitively, and there are multiple possibilities. So we'll start with the what I think is the least likely is that it was chosen because one of the members of the Lewis and Clark expedition was named Richard Windsor. Lisa Jackson and the EPA have asserted that the name Richard Windsor was chosen either because of a dog that Lisa Jackson owned during a time in her life when she lived in East Windsor Township, New Jersey, or simply because she was born in East Windsor Township, New Jersey. Neither of those really seem plausible to me. It also seems odd to me that they would choose a male name. Why not choose Rachel Windsor, right? I mean, if it's Lisa Jackson who is the head of the EPA, you would think you would choose a female name. The other possibility, and the one which I think is most likely, although this is speculation, is that Richard Windsor, that name was chosen because there was an environmental lawyer who practiced in Florida named Richard Windsor. In fact, the Richard Windsor that I'm referring to, the deceased Richard Windsor, he died in 2008, interestingly enough.
Not only do we have dead people vote, we have dead people's email accounts.
Well, yeah, that's definitely an interesting angle. But the reason that I suspect that it's this Richard Windsor is that we know that he was something of an activist lawyer. He's mentioned in a book called Government Pirates, which talks about what I would refer to as illegal government takings of property through regulation. This is a topic, actually, that Ron Calzone here in Missouri has talked about quite a lot. I don't know if he's familiar with this particular case because it occurred in Florida. But nonetheless, it's the sort of problem where you have these regulatory agencies that use the legal system in order to take property. In this particular case, a man named O.C. and his son Casey were sent to jail. The jury that found them guilty, the foreman on the jury knew people in the EPA who spoke pretty ill of O.C., so the jury pool was poisoned. We know that one of the jurors came forward. This is all covered in the book Government Pirates, by the way. One of the jurors came forward and told O.C. this after O.C. had been in jail. And so O.C. and his son tried to pursue a means of getting their name cleared, and the judge ruled that even though the jury pool had been poisoned, that it just wasn't – it didn't rise to the level of, you know, removing the felony from their records. So they wind up, you know, essentially their reputations have been stained for the past 20 years because of this legal action that I don't know if Richard Windsor precipitated the legal action, but he was a lawyer at the trial. So, you know, I think he is certainly on the activist side of the environmental movement.
Do we know if there's any other connection between Lisa Jackson and Richard Windsor other than just this hypothetical?
We do. Let me talk about that. There are actually there's evidence of a couple of other connections. One, Richard Windsor was working in the reason that I found this information about O.C. and Casey was that there's this reference in that book to Richard Windsor and the fact that he was an attorney in Florida's EPA in the 80s, and this would have carried on into the 90s until about 96. During that time, I believe it was 91 to 93, I might be off on the years a little bit, Carol Browner was the head of environmental regulation for Florida. Now, Carol Browner went on to become the administrator of the EPA, the position that Lisa Jackson currently holds. Carol Browner was the administrator of the EPA under the Clinton administration, and she would have been the administrator of the EPA in 2000. When the Florida recount was occurring. So I'm speculating that because of the Florida recount and the embarrassment that that would have caused Carol mm-hmm. Browner, because not only was she from Florida, but she was also a former legislative director for one Senator Al Gore, that she may have taken action to set up an account for a friend of hers. Now, at the time, it may have been perfectly legitimate, but I believe that that account has persisted from sometime during the Clinton years, and I'm speculating that it was precipitated by the recount in 2000, and then it continues to this day, and that it was handed off to Lisa Jackson more recently. Now, I believe Lisa Jackson has used the account probably since the beginning of the Obama administration. And so the questions that I would have, that I would pose to the government about this are, when was the EPA's Richard Windsor account created? Like, I think they should be able to identify the date on which that account was created.
Sure.
Who was granted access to it? Because we know based on other news reports that have come out over the past couple of weeks that it's been a practice for high-level EPA officials, and to the best of my understanding, it's really only the administrator of the EPA, but I don't know that for certain. It's been a practice of the high-level EPA officials to use these alias accounts. And finally, so who was granted access? You know, was it Lisa Browner? Was it the Bush administration's EPA administrator? Lisa Jackson and Carol Browner as well. And lastly, the last question that I would have is, when was each custodian granted access? In other words, you want to understand, like, how many people have access to this account, whether access overlaps, you know, are there multiple people accessing it?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we want to find out. Now, let
and what's
me get
on
back
the account?
To, yeah, exactly. That's another question. So let's get back to that. That ties into the FOIA requests that Christopher Horner and CEI have filed. They're concerned that the responses that they've gotten from the EPA have not fully complied with the law in that they've only gotten responses from Lisa Jackson's email account, not the Richard Windsor email account. And so they believe that the EPA is trying to circumvent the law by not providing those responses. There's also a concern, which, you know, I haven't been able to explore this because I haven't been able to find, you know, evidence one way or the other on it, that Lisa Jackson might be using a personal email account for public business. Now, public employees who do that, they're not legally shielding those emails. They still have a legal obligation to provide emails sent on their personal accounts if they fall within the specifications of a FOIA request. And we know that this has happened elsewhere in the administration. There have been personal emails used, for instance, to coordinate meetings between White House employees and lobbyists, often specifically for the lobbyists to avoid having to sign the guest registry at the White House. So they'll set up a meeting at a coffee house outside of the White House, essentially dodging that public record. And there are also other examples of government sock puppetry, if you will. The term sock puppet means everybody knows what a sock puppet is, but it's the idea of taking taking a false name and using it to further a position. I don't know if you've heard about this, but James O'Keefe, you probably heard that he was prosecuted in New Orleans a number of years ago. The prosecutor, I can't remember her first name, last name is Mann, she was recently demoted for having set up and used sock puppet comment accounts on news sites in the New Orleans area. She was using these accounts to kind of further her agenda, obviously.
She was going online to comment on news stories under an alias.
Exactly.
And as a prosecutor, you can't do that.
Correct. Now, I don't know if there were other factors in her demotion, but I do know that she was demoted.
Okay.
So the point being, we really need to expect our public employees, the people who are working for us, to be transparent with us. I mean, they have an obligation to be transparent with us.
Absolutely. So let's get back to what information was being asked for in this FOIA request. Do you know?
I don't know the specifics of that, but let me switch gears a little bit. The fallout from what's happened recently is that the Institute for Energy Research has opened FOIA requests to find out, specifically asking for emails from the Richard Windsor account regarding the pipeline, and I'm blanking on the name of it, the oil pipeline from Canada.
Keystone?
Down to, yes, the Keystone Pipeline. So there's this now ripple effect where you're going to see other agents or other organizations. The Institute for Energy Research is a nonprofit organization that wants to further the use of oil and other fossil fuels, I guess. And so they have filed a request to get emails related to from that Richard Windsor account that pertain to that pipeline to see if there's any evidence that that account was used to coordinate with activist groups or really what sort of information was what sort of information was disseminated through that account.
So when someone files a request, a FOIA request, do they have to have the specific name of the account they want the request from? Or can you just say, I want XYZ information off of any communications from Lisa Jackson?
You can actually say that you can name the person that you want the information from. And this is kind of where I was going earlier, in that if you ask for all the communications, all the email communications of Lisa Jackson, then that implies that any time she's created a public record, even if that public record was on her personal email account, she has an obligation to provide that. That's the idea behind the Freedom of Information Act.
Right.
And so that if public employees are using their personal email accounts for public business, or if they're using alias email accounts, then that really that's what poses the problem. That's what shows a kind of an erosion of transparency within our government.
Okay. And so the crux of the matter is that Lisa Jackson has at least one, she could have several, alias email accounts from which she's conducting business at the White House on EPA business.
Correct.
And no one knows, you know, about these email accounts in order to be able to uncover whatever deals are being struck over the internet or information that could be pertinent to serious situations like the Keystone Pipeline or any other Environmental Protection Agency issues.
Correct, correct. The, you know, there is one last thing I want to mention. As far as Richard Windsor goes, the pseudonym Richard Windsor, I haven't actually blogged about this, but a couple of people have. There is a richardwindsor.com, which is not safe for work, so I would encourage you not to go there, that was set up in, I think it was the spring of 2008. So what's interesting is if Lisa Jackson did choose the name Richard Windsor, that would have been chosen, you know, late 2008, probably early 2009. She probably should have done some due diligence and discovered that this richardwindsor.com is really a not-safe-for-work website. She probably should not have chosen that name. In fact, I think that that's going to come back to haunt her. There was a post in Planet Gore, which is the branch of National Review that covers environmental issues, that talked a little bit about this. That post was actually put up by Christopher Horner of CEI. So it's a punishment fetish website. So
not safe for work.
Very interesting choice of names.
Very good. Okay, Darren. So as far as any information that has been, are they denying any information coming off of her email accounts? Is she turning over the pertinent information?
At this point, they have acknowledged that the Richard Windsor account is used by Lisa Jackson. I believe that they have maintained that they have provided information responsive to the requests, the FOIA requests. I believe that the response to that has been that CEI and others have filed additional FOIA requests to narrow those requests, specifically asking for emails from that Richard Windsor account. We know that the Richard Windsor account exists because you can send emails to windsor.richard@epa.gov. Mm-hmm. That's the structure of EPA email addresses. If you do a search, you remember earlier I mentioned that you can search by name for any EPA employee. Mm-hmm. They do not have any employee named Richard Windsor, and yet they have an active email address for one Richard Windsor. So that's, you know, pretty conclusive evidence, plus their admission that it's there.
I guess
if you want to contact Lisa Jackson, write to windsor.richard@epa.gov, and you're probably talking directly to her.
Okay, and as far as the content of the information that they're looking for, we don't really know at this time?
They're still working on it. We just coming off of the Thanksgiving break, I have not heard that any of the responses to the FOIA requests have come back. And in fact, I didn't make this clear, but the CEI and Christopher Horner have filed suit. So, I mean, it's gotten to the point where these things are probably going to develop more in court, at least as far as Christopher Horner and the Competitive Enterprise Institute are concerned, in order to try and pry free the information as opposed to responses to the FOIA requests.
Okay. So as of today, she could be getting a lot of information requests from a lot of people. Let's hope.
Yeah.
And hopefully she will comply. Okay. Darren, thanks for that update. I hope you'll come back and keep us updated if any conclusive information comes forward on what's going on under those accounts or if there are any other sock puppet accounts that arise out of the EPA and anything that they can contain.
Thank you, Lisa. I appreciate the time. Again, you can check my blog, rebootcongress.net. I will have more information up in the morning. I did an interview with Daniel Simmons of the Institute for Energy Research, and so I'll have some information about what they're doing and their FOIA requests concerning the Keystone Pipeline in the morning. Again, that's rebootcongress.net. Thanks again,
Lisa. Thank you, Darren. Have a good evening.
Take care.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Liz Trent.
and the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@missourigrassrootscoalition.org for details.
And our leadership abroad are inextricably linked. Our friends and allies must again be able to trust us. From Israel to Colombia, from Poland to the Philippines, our allies and friends have to know that we will be reliable and consistent and determined. And our foes can have no reason to doubt our resolve, because peace really does come through strength.
Just when you thought it was all over, when you thought it was time to hang it all up, Lisa is back.
Welcome back. You're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio, and this is Lisa Payne Nager, and you are listening to the Culture Vigilante Hour here every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. We have with us tonight Liz Trent of spiritofresistance.org. Spiritofresistance.org, right, Liz?
No, it's blogspot.com.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. Thank you.
No problem.
Okay. So anyway, Liz is with us not only to correct me on my miscommunications of her website blog, but to talk to us about some information about what we all need to understand, especially with this is actually part of the Obamacare issue that's going to be hitting us all in the face after the first of the year, and some underlying aspects of it called medical jihad. And she's going to give us an understanding of what that means and how that's going to affect us possibly in the near future. Thanks for being with us tonight, Liz.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lisa. I really appreciate it. I just wanted to remind your listeners that what I did was I took about a year's worth of investigative reporting. I love being on your show because it's sort of an homage to the citizen journalist, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And, yeah, I really enjoyed listening to your first guest there, Darren. So what I did was is I investigated our area and specifically St. Louis, and what I am finding are some connections. So I'm going to connect the dots. And I made a video. It's about 24 minutes, which is a little bit long for a YouTube video. However, I felt it was really important to include everything and tie it together so that people could see the connections. And United West put out the video. It's Civilization Medical Jihad St. Louis Exposed. And I think it's really important. You know, we become complacent and we forget to really pay attention to what's going on. But the Islam, the doctrine of Islam, has an effect on the psyche of the Islamic doctor, the jihadist doctor. And it doesn't take long to remind your listeners about Fort Hood and to talk about how Major Hassan was a physician. He was a psychiatrist, actually, which means he had a medical degree. And in my video, I go through a long list of physicians who are attendants and on the board of the Dar al-Islam Mosque in Baldwin, Missouri. And as a matter of fact, one of these doctors just this year, his name is Abid Nassar. He's a licensed doctor both in Missouri and in Illinois. And he has pled guilty this year to distributing and receiving misbranded prescription drugs. And he did administer these cancer drugs to patients. And some of those patients actually passed away while using this medication. And so this is really serious, and I think it's really important to note that these particular doctors, these Pakistani doctors, they are graduates from a university in Punjab, Pakistan, and they belong to a group called the let's see, it's APNA, A-P-P-N-A. It's Association of Pakistani Physicians North America. And this particular group seems to take in a large amount of zakat, and they do a lot of fundraising.
Zakat?
And zakat. This is the Islamic tithing.
Okay.
And, of course, Islamic tithing used to be against law, but now we have a president who reinstated the ability to give the zakat, because we know zakat generally, a large portion will go for jihad, and so that's a big problem. But, you know, there's a book, it's a great book called Jihad and American Medicine, and it's by Dr. Adam Frederick Doran. And it's really interesting because after I investigated this and I found out about Dr. Nassar and distributing these cancer drugs in St. Louis and finding out that he was a member of the mosque, it says here on page 13, he goes into great detail about counterfeit drugs. And he says that the FBI has picked up chatter between Al-Qaeda cells describing a plan to double the dose of an ingredient in a common cholesterol-lowering medicine, Lipitor, in hopes of inducing liver failure in millions of American patients. So, you know, when we're looking at a situation, you know, we're not going to accuse a person, but we can look at the whole situation and just sort of connect the dots. You know, he is on the board. His wife, we have pictures of him with a woman named Ghazala Hayat, who is a member of ISNA. We know that ISNA was discovered in the Holy Land Foundation trial to be the number one Muslim Brotherhood front group in the United States. We see that these doctors who are members of ISNA are also members of APNA, which is a group I just told you about. And mm-hmm. when we look at when they have their events, what we see is doctors who are not discussing medicine. We see doctors discussing politics. And since you and I know that Islam is really about politics, it's about civilization, jihad, and sort of taking over from within, you know, that's not a good sign. And we also know that this particular mosque, I filmed a young man there who was praising Anwar al-Awlaki. And, of course, Anwar was the man who inspired the Fort Hood killer, which would be Major Hassan. So, you know, when you kind of connect those dots, you start to wonder if we're getting complacent and we need to sort of enact some more stricter regulations. Are we not paying attention to what's happening in the medical community and looking at the potential for harm, for jihadist activity? And then I also wanted to talk about the Hippocratic Oath, which is very important because we know when we look at Islamic doctrine, and we can look in the Hadith, which is the traditions of Muhammad, and we can look in the Quran, and we can see verses. Here's one from the Hadith. It says, the prophet said, if I take an oath and later find something else better than that, then I do what's better to expiate my oath. And here's one from the Quran. Allah and his messengers dissolve obligations. Here's another one, Quran 66:2. Allah has already sanctioned you for the dissolution of your vows. So, you know, John.
So the ends justify the means in all things in the Quran, in the Islamic religion, that the ends justify the means. Lying is okay. Committing crimes is okay as long as it furthers the mission of Allah.
Exactly. And, you know, John Adams, he said our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. Of course, he's talking about Judeo-Christianity and the Ten Commandments. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. So if the Muslim community, and they consider themselves the Ummah, for example, when I filmed this young man praising Anwar at the mosque, he said that Anwar was having a great effect on the Muslim community. Well, what's the difference between the Muslim community and the American community? Why is there a distinction there? Because they see themselves as Muslims, and we are not. There's dualism. We are kafirs. We are non-Muslims. They are Muslims. So this, you know, our form of government is not adequate for Muslims who want to follow Muhammad's example, which under Western standards is really barbaric.
Absolutely. Okay, so basically the term medical jihad, and we have an example of it here in St. Louis. There's been a doctor who's been convicted already of for lack of a better term, malpractice.
Right, and you know what he did do too, Lisa? He actually These drugs were imported through some people in California, and they were traced back to India, and those people also were charged, and they were in trouble. And, you know, he charged Medicaid, that would be the American taxpayers, for the original price of what the American medicine would cost, which would have been about three times as much. So although he may have paid $300,000 for the medicines, he billed us $1 million.
Wow.
And again, this goes back to the clash of civilizations, the morality difference, which is there to perform jihad against non-Muslims, to do whatever it takes to deceive and do whatever it takes, dissolve their Hippocratic oath. They don't really have to follow it because they're worshiping their God. And of course, our system is completely opposite of Sharia law. So, we have the golden rule. We would treat our neighbors as we treat ourselves. So we would certainly not distribute these types of medications to patients. So there's that clash going on there, and so we really have to examine what's going on, because I'll tell you what, Missouri has allowed him to continue to practice medicine. Now, Illinois pulled his license, but Missouri continues to do that, the medical arts board. And, you know, you really have to, you know, talk to your listeners. Maybe somebody needs to reevaluate what are some of those rules, especially when we consider what the Quran says about, you know, following obligations.
Right. Okay. So how do we, this just makes my head spin. So how do you vet this kind of thing out? Because there is under Obamacare, there is going to be an influx of doctors, Islamic believing doctors coming into this country. I mean, we're going to lose American practicing physicians through Obamacare, and there's already an influx of doctors coming from Islamic countries to practice medicine here in the
right.
in the United States.
Right. Well, what we have to do is we have to keep doing what we've been doing, and we have to continue the effort. And I know a lot of people were a little bit disillusioned after the election, but it really is absolutely imperative that your lawyers and your judges and your politicians understand what's going on, and individuals have to contact your politicians, let them know, and you're going to have to create stricter laws and regulations, and people who are listening or have influence or know physicians need to get on the horn with the medical arts board. And you know, really there's politicians now have said we can't have Muslims in the army. You know, we don't know when they're going to turn and shoot our guys. And so, you know, maybe we just can't have these practicing physicians, or the minute they do something such as this, you know, certainly Missouri should have pulled his license permanently. And that's just my opinion. You know, I don't understand why he would still be practicing medicine in, you know, St. Louis.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if he's been discharged in an adjoining state from practicing medicine for malpractice, I mean, certainly that should be looked into here. And this man makes a lot of money, from what I understand. He's quite wealthy.
Well, yes, and his wife's a physician also. But I've got to be honest with you. They seem to be living a lifestyle that's even more so than what I would think of it, you know, as a physician would have. You know, we have family members or physicians, we have friends, and we're capitalists. We're happy for them to make a lot of money, but they usually live in $800,000 homes, $400,000. This guy has a $2 million, dollar home, and it's sort of beyond, and it really raises concerns considering the oath issue about fraud with Medicaid and Medicare, and you really ought to have Usama come discuss about Obamacare and how it will allow these doctors to come receive citizenship fairly quickly, and then bring their family members, which, again, you know, what we know for sure about Islam is as the population grows, the demands get worse and the pressure on the community and the political pressure, and, you know, pretty soon we'll be looking like United Kingdom, which is unhealthy.
Absolutely. Well, we're so close to that already. Okay, so you sent me a KSDK report, a link to that story, and it's up at spiritofresistance.blogspot.com, but I'm also going to put it up at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for anybody to see who wants to see that. And this is just something that folks have to be aware of. I mean, you know, with at the risk of being called a racist, I think you really do need to check out the credentials of the physicians that you see under these conditions. If this is a case that, you know, if these cases continue to pop up in the country and we see these kinds of malpractice issues come up with doctors coming from Islamic countries to the United States, and you look at their history, I think it's something that folks need to be aware of.
Yeah, and just one more thing real quick before I let you go. If we have any listeners who are very serious and would like to look into this, get the Jihad in American Medicine. It's available on Amazon by Adam Frederick Doran. And on page, let me see what page is this, 119, chapter 11, he gives a list of what a patient can do to protect themselves. And I think there's about 19 tips that he has here. And that's very good. Very good reading.
Okay, the name of that book again is?
Is Jihad and American Medicine.
It okay, says, very good.
Thinking like a terrorist to anticipate attacks on our health system.
Okay, it's something you need to be aware of, folks. It's happening out there. You know, after the election, everything's up for grabs, so you need to be proactive in how you're taking care of yourself. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you.
Go to spiritofresistance.blogspot.com, and I'll throw that link up at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. as well. Thanks very much, Liz. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Lisa. Bye-bye.
Okay. We'll take a break, and we'll come back with Ray Cuneo.
This is the Grassroots Minute. Missouri's Department of Tourism a few years back used the slogan, "Wake up to Missouri." After this political season, the Tea Party and grassroots movements are in a fight for their lives against the establishment GOP, and I believe we now need a new slogan, Wake Up Missouri. The Patriot Movement has fallen back asleep and are allowing the establishment Republicans to gain a foothold once again and gain control of our state. A couple of years ago, we elected grassroots Tea Party candidates who were compromised by the establishment, and in a short time were no longer putting citizens and state of Missouri first, but the lobbyists and PACs. This past August, Texas, Indiana, Wisconsin, they elected successful Tea Party candidates where we allowed the establishment to bring in their Democratic Union cronies to steal away our election. Wake up, Missouri. We need to unite. We need to get stronger. We need to get smarter. We need to organize the way that we all intended to. It's not too late for Missouri. It's not too late to take a stand and wake up and do what's necessary by getting out and back to our grassroots and talking to our families and neighbors and our friends and church members. Attend your local Tea Party meeting and let your voices be heard once again. Missouri Grassroots Coalition is taking a lead in bringing together those patriot organizations to take a stand and one strong voice to get our message out with the strength to tell the politicians, to tell the candidates, to tell the establishment, we're not taking it anymore. We're madder than hell, and we want our rights, our freedoms, and most of all, we want our state and country back. Join Missouri Grassroots Coalition. Have your group become an affiliate, and let's get this train back on track, steaming towards a depot of victory and freedom. I'm Terry Boyd.
I've got a feeling that the night is
so dear, for peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
We're back. This is Missouri Grassroots Radio, and this is Lisa Payne Nager, and you are listening to your Culture Vigilante Hour. Every week we've had the pleasure of having Ray Cuneo on with us. He's done a great job in giving us an education about Agenda 21, and it's starting to resonate across the country a little bit more than it has in the past. As in the last couple of weeks, Glenn Beck has published a book on Agenda 21, and he's been featuring it quite a bit on his programming. And there was an email in my inbox last week from the Glenn Beck organization listing just a number of buzzwords that we have been either overlooking or ignoring or not aware of over the last, over more than a decade for me. I mean, I've heard some of these words for quite some time. And all of these buzzwords are linked to issues promoting Agenda 21, and you don't even know it. So I had a conversation earlier this week with Ray Cuneo, and what we would like to do within the next few weeks is talk about some of these buzzwords, bring them to your attention, so that when you have an opportunity to come across them, and you will on a daily basis once you start paying attention, come across these buzzwords and understand that these are all linked to promoting Agenda 21 policies. So let's take a real quick listen to that interview with Ray, and we will be back in a few.
This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. We're here once again with Ray Cuneo, again to discuss the issues of Agenda 21 and how it's creeping into your everyday life, and you don't even know it. A few days ago, I received an email from The Blaze. Glenn Beck has picked this issue up, thank God, and he's published a book about Agenda 21, and it's starting to become a little bit more of the popular vernacular out there. And he sent a list of catchphrases or popular phrases associated with Agenda 21. And what we'd like to do today is introduce you to some of those phrases so that you can recognize them when they come up in front of you and you understand where which path you're being led down as opposed to, you know, maintaining your freedoms. And these issues in Agenda 21 just touch on every aspect of government and every level of government from your hometown community all the way up to the federal government. So we kind of want to go through some of these phrases so that you're familiar with them. And thank you for being with us today, Ray, to help us do that.
Well, it's my pleasure being here, and we never run out of things to talk about when it comes to Agenda 21, unfortunately.
It's just a huge, huge, all-encompassing subject, and it has so many fingers, and it goes down so many avenues, and it's already taken so many of your freedoms away, you don't even realize that it's attached to this issue. So the more I think that people are familiar with the phrases, the catchphrases that go along with it, Glenn Beck calls it a keyword list, the more you'll be able to recognize it and make your legislators aware of it. And it's not necessarily that your legislators and your representatives are trying to take you down this road. They're not even aware of it themselves. This situation has been so subversive, but you kind of catch on to some of these things, and they sound so innocuous, you just are swept away with the tide. So what we really want to be able to do is to bring attention to these things so that red flags will start being raised when you hear this being talked about in the common culture. Where should we start, Ray? I've got this list in front of me. I can read it off. It's a pretty lengthy list, and as you pointed out to me earlier, this lengthy list does not even include some of the more serious and severe agendas within this situation. So we'll probably need to add to this list as well.
Well, and you're right. I'm glad to see that Beck, I guess he published this here, and it's a really good start, don't get me wrong. But, you know, having been involved in this issue for almost 20 years now in the capacity of, well, citizens' private property rights, and then as a planning and zoning member on Franklin County Commission Planning and Zoning, then 8 years as a Soil and Water Board here in Franklin County, a lot of these, I have firsthand experience with a lot of these terms and words and phrases, and they do have profound meaning. A lot of people just kind of glance over them, and I think your point is well taken there, and it's really important that so many of our elected officials, these words are put to our elected officials and our appointed officials in documents, important documents, be it legislation, be it ordinances at the local level, be it comprehensive or master planning. They're put in there, and they sound, like you, as you pointed out, innocuous. They don't sound threatening at all. In fact, some of them sound kind of appealing, but I can tell you, as a planning and zoning commissioner, that having went through this and knowing what these words mean and then seeing presented by planners, by consultants to the officials, in these massive documents, even at the local level, they're massive documents many times, and at the federal level, they're many thousands of pages, that the elected and appointed officials and their staff people, they just kind of just, you know, skim over and say, well, that sounds good, it must be okay. And that's how it gets into ordinances and statutes or laws and regulations. So,
okay, I'm going to go ahead and read through this list,
sure.
And then we'll go back and we'll pull some of these things out and we'll discuss it a little bit. It's a pretty good list. It's a pretty long list. Affordable housing, ballot box planning, benefit of all, benefits-driven, buffer zones, cap and trade, choice, climate change, common core curriculum, that's a big one with me, common good, community protocol, comprehensive planning consensus, conservation easement, direct instruction, downzoning, endangered species, environmental impact report, environmental justice, equity, facilitator, fair, general plan, global warming, good business sense, grants, greenhouse gas emissions, green ways, growth management, habitat, HEAL, which stands for Healthy Eating, Active Living, communities, healthy communities strategy, high-speed rail, historic preservation, housing element, inclusive, interdisciplinary, international baccalaureate, another educational term, international council on local, environmental initiatives, with an acronym ICLEI, invasive species, job housing connections, land use policies, lifelong learning, livable communities, livable communities again, local government for sustainability, metropolitan planning organizations, mixed use development, modeling, multi-use dwellings, new economy, new urbanism, new world order, one planet communities, open space, outcome-based education, outcomes, parking policy, precautionary approach, precautionary principle, preserve, priority conservation areas, priority development areas, prosperity, protect, public-private partnerships, quality of life, redevelopment, regional, resilient cities, responsible development, restoration, safe routes to schools, sanctuary, scenic views and vistas, school to work, sensitive lands, smart growth, smart streets, social justice, stack and pack housing, stakeholder, sustainable communities initiative, sustainable communities partnership, sustainable communities strategies, sustainable development, sustainable economic development, sustainable medicine, the three E's of sustainable equity, economy, environment, traffic calming, transit-oriented development, transportation justice, triple bottom line, upzoning, urban growth boundary, urban revitalization, vehicle mileage travel tax, vibrant neighborhoods, vision, visioning meetings, walkable communities, watersheds, wetlands, wildlands. Many of these words, Ray, we've discussed already on the program. Many of these words we've been hearing for years. Some of these education terms I've been hearing for years. I was on a school board more than 10 years ago. And some of these terms were popular back then for the educational issues. Some of these things we hear every day. We've been hearing them for years.
Well, absolutely, it's become part of our I guess you would say our society, our narrative in society about various issues of how people live, where they live. I would add a couple to that just for kicks here: protecting nighttime sky, land trust. I think we talked about scenic highways, scenic rivers, wildlife corridors. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, and all of these here tie into, most of them tie into the issue of land use, resource use. Now, you pointed out some in education that goes back and ties into outcome-based education and all these things, and that's totally, totally accurate. But as far as the land use, and the issue of land use, where people live, the resources, again, as we've covered before, they tie into either the area of smart growth, which in my thinking ties into the urban issue of sustainable development. In the more rural areas of the United States, it's the wildland project. So all of these, and some of these have overlapping terms. One doesn't necessarily totally apply just to smart growth around metropolitan areas or to the wildlands project. They're all part of, as you said, the vernacular at the federal level, state level, local level, and they become even into the corporate world, into the business world. We see them that they have been picked up and used because it is politically correct to be green, if you will, or to be sustainable. And most of these corporations have no idea what the term means. Yes, a lot of these words, sustainable, they're old words, but with new meaning.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the people that use them are the corporate or the business world. They have no idea. Hey, it's just something government says they're pushing, and yeah, we want to be politically correct. We want to make sure we're not losing consumers because we're not politically correct. So, but words have they have meaning, and people need to understand now. And this is where every individual has a responsibility. When they should, first of all, be engaged in their government at all levels. They should know and try to follow as best they can what government is doing. And so when you run across this, and let's just use an example at the local level. When you go to a planning and zoning meeting or a commissioner meeting or a city council meeting, and you pick up documents that may be being reviewed, or you hear the terms used, you need to find out in what context they're being used and how it is impacting local government and the ordinances that may come forth from that. And I would advise people to do this. I found it much better than if you run across these words being used and you're at a council meeting or you're at the planning and zoning or commission meeting and you hear some of these words thrown around, or you pick up a document and you hear the officials talk about it. Rather than getting up and attacking your officials, because I won't say nine chances out of ten, but it's a good chance that the very officials that are reading the documents and talking about it may not even understand the words that they're using and in what context, what meaning it has. So, when you run across these things, make sure you get the written documents from your local government and say, hey, okay, this is what it pertains to, this ordinance or to this master plan. And then I would advise you to go to your elected official, your local elected official, and say, Mr. Councilman or Mrs. Councilman, do you understand? Tell me what you think this word means. Do you understand? Talk to them one-on-one, because I found that in a public meeting, if you get up, and I've seen this done where people get up and they say, do you understand what this impact, this issue has, or this word has? And so I guess it's human nature that people don't like to be embarrassed.
Sure.
So a lot of these officials put up a shield, and, you know, they automatically peg you as a radical. So I think when you run across these words, particularly at the local level, that you go, like I said, go to your local official and just sit down with them if you have time and say, you know what, you represent me here, and let me show you what I think this word means and in what context it's being used and what implications that may have in terms of land use or people's activities. Now, you know, to me, land use is a euphemism for people control. I mean, when land control, people control are the same thing, because when you control land, you control people. We've said this before on other segments.
Right.
And but there's so many important words here that, you know, we can go through in quite a bit of detail, and I think maybe in future segments we can spend a lot of time on certain areas or phrases here, like biosphere reserves. Now that's a big, and I mentioned it in other segments, but I think it bears more now that we're at this point in words and phrases. It's more important that people understand what that is, biosphere reserves and heritage areas. We talked about social justice or environmental justice. I was looking here, one that we could do pretty quick here. Let's just talk about growth, urban growth boundaries. Now, that's an interesting one.
Okay.
Because urban growth boundaries ties to the land use aspect of smart growth around the metropolitan areas. Bottom line is urban growth boundaries, the sustainable development folks want no peripheral expansion of development, peripheral development of expansion around cities and towns and urban areas. They want to push everything in, as we've discussed before, stack and pack, but they do not want any peripheral expansion. A prime example, and this happened about the time that Agenda 21 was Americanized here in the United States, because a lot of this, believe it or not, a lot of this Agenda 21 stuff, our government was deeply involved in a lot of UN conferences leading up to the 1992 Rio Conference, where it became official UN policy. And I mean, many federal agencies were traveling around the world and contributing to a lot of this terminology. At any rate, about 1992 or 93, the poster child for urban growth boundaries was Portland, Oregon. And Portland, Oregon, basically, to put it in a very simple term, there was three county area. And they said, hey, we want to implement sustainable development, urban growth boundaries. So the planners and the officials went and pretty much arbitrarily, if you can mentally visualize, drew a circle around the three county area in the Portland, Oregon area. And basically anything on the end, there was no development allowed anything outside of that circle, except perhaps, maybe one house every 10 years, perhaps.
Wow.
And under very tight restrictions and controls, even if that happened. So what happens to land values and people's ability to utilize the property rights? Basically, well, certainly land values fell right to the bottom if you had land on the outside, because nobody wanted to buy land out here because they weren't certain. First of all, you couldn't build on it. They weren't certain how much, to what degree you could use it. When you got on the inside of that circle, then land values went right through the roof to where the average person couldn't afford any individual housing or land ownership, the average person. So what happens if you lived in that inside of that circle? You went into the stack and pack little community or the apartment concept, if you lived there. So Portland, Oregon lived under that for, oh gosh, I guess 25 years or 30 years, but it got so overbearing that, and I can't recall the proposition number. I want to say it was Prop 37 or something like that. A couple of years ago, they finally overturned that. But that is urban growth boundaries. That was really the poster child for what sustainable development they want to accomplish. But that was really far, the extreme, because they just pretty much arbitrarily went and drew a boundary around that, around Portland, Oregon, and stopped everything. But they learned that that probably wasn't the right way to do it. They went at it from a more, underhanded way, and started using planners and said, hey, you know, we're going to start working on master plans, comprehensive planning, and ordinances that are going to piecemeal these restrictions and basically accomplish the same thing, with the goal meaning that we don't want any peripheral development.
So it's better to slow boil your results.
In previous segment, when we talked about planning and zoning, we touched on some of the ways that from the master plan, which is the blueprint for your local ordinances, local government can very much dictate where you're going to live through zoning or planning, or even if they permit some development, as we covered. Some of these developments are so expensive to do that if any developer decides to do it and can afford to do it on their own, because basically the lending institutions don't like to get involved in any property development where basically local government says, hey, we're a partner in this development, and you can well understand why.
Mm-hmm.
The lending institution wouldn't want to do that. Because if for some reason the project fell through, then a bank or lending institution could be sitting there holding the bag on property that they may not be able to use at all on some of it or in a very limited way.
All very restrictive. So it's all very restrictive, and it's another version, as you've put it in the past, slow boiling to get your results. It's just a little piece at a time here where they're just, you know, taking one little initiative here, one little initiative there, and passing it, and you don't even know that it's happening to you.
Well, and a lot of people don't realize it. They say, okay, I want to go out and buy a house out here in a development or in a subdivision. Well, okay, maybe they can afford it, maybe they can't. Maybe it's too high-end. Even if one of these conservation developments are approved, it's very much upper crust level, meaning the high-end, to where the average person can't afford. And though there's many restrictives, and it's not just development covenants that are put on by the developer, but it is actual restrictions put on by local government as to where you can do, what you can do, and so on and so forth. So all of these add to the no growth concept of sustainable development.
Okay. Next week, we're going to pull out a few of these terms and go into detail a little bit more about how these terms can really affect you personally and what's going to happen if your local government buys into this brainwashing method that the UN is selling to our government on all levels. And
And you know, I hope the listeners out here don't think we're getting too far into the weeds in detail, because it's so important they understand how it reaches out and touches them. If these are just not broad concepts that are at some level of government, this is actually stuff that, as you pointed out very well, that we're being, you know, faced with every day, and it impacts us, but it's being incrementally implemented and has been over a number of years that you just really, gosh, as I said before, you're slow boiled and you don't even know it.
Right. I'm going to put this list up at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org so that you'll be able to look at this list, and hopefully we will be adding to it as time goes by if there are some important topics that come up that factor into this list. And next week, Ray, we'll pick a few of these items out and hit them a little bit more in detail.
Sounds good.
Okay, thanks for being with us today, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Ray.
Okay, folks, very interesting, very serious topics. Go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, and I'll have a list of most of these issues up there for you to take a look at, some links for you to maybe go and follow up on your own, because that's what we want you to do here at Culture Vigilante. You've got to take care of this on your own. Nobody else is going to do it for you. You've got to take control of this if you want to get your government back. Next Monday night, Dave Court will have the Hour of Truth. We are going to have a little bit of lineup changes in the coming weeks, but Monday night Dave Court will be with you again for the Hour of Truth, and he's going to continue his discussion on the Constitution. I'll be back here on Wednesday night with you for your Culture Vigilante Hour. Kevin Harned will be here tomorrow night and next Thursday night. Mr. Hillbilly Logic will be taking care of business on Thursdays, and this Friday we'll have the Friday Evening Roundtable. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and join. If you haven't had the opportunity to do that, you heard that in the Grassroots Minute tonight, please sign up. We've got a legislative session that's beginning to start up. I have a funny feeling that we're going to have some issues with this insurance exchange situation. It's going to take the voice of 10,000 patriots across Missouri united behind this issue to be able to be heard, I think, by our legislature. I think that what we're going to find with that situation is that they're all going to hide behind the fact that even though we've all supported Prop C, we supported Prop E, they're going to throw their hands up in the air and tell us, well, there's just nothing that we can do because it's a federal law, and federal law states Trump laws, or Trump's state laws. So, sorry. Too bad. Well, that's not going to be good enough. There are a number of states out there who have made stronger stands against this issue, filed lawsuits and whatnot, and we want our legislature in Missouri to stand up and be a stronger voice for what the people really want. So go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and sign up for that You can get also our grassroots alerts. You can sign up for those when we send out grass fire alerts. You can get those sent directly to your cell phone immediately as they happen. When there's an emergency, we'll send those out immediately so that you can be informed and engaged. And thank you, folks. Thanks to all the folks who have helped us with our Secret Santa project. Please, just because we've reached our goal doesn't mean that we won't continue to donate more money. If you're feeling generous, feeling the holiday spirit, send us some more cash, and we will make sure that gets to some needy families here in Missouri. And until next week, we will talk to you again here on the Culture Vigilante Hour. Thanks for being with us.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.